Hi everybody, thanks for coming. My name is Barry, work for Arica. It's really great to see you all here. I suppose there's some things that I should say to introduce things. Bryony always keeps me straight, but we haven't actually just talked about what I would say. So perhaps the main thing to say is that it's really great to see you and to have Norbessie and Fred here and our other guests that are going to be taking part in the weekend. We were lucky enough to work with Fred in New York last year. And since then, I've been rereading his book and thinking a lot about his writing and thinking about how we would engage with it. And a really important thing for the development of Arica, as we've been working over the last few years, is to really understand the kind of the connections between aesthetics and their social or political stakes, or what they kind of mean in the world. And it's been very influential for us to think about the Black radical tradition in America and the explicit links it makes between a kind of a community politics and the language and gestures and habits that it kind of develops, which formulate themselves into a set of aesthetics or art forms or something. But I didn't want to do anything that was going to be make the Black radical aesthetic something that's exotic and that we would bring here and turn it into an object that's from some other kind of like exotic culture. So it seems that to us that the best thing to do would be to think about like this with Emma, for instance, our friend Emma, maybe think about the situatedness of where we are and where that tradition comes from, and perhaps find themes within it that would be something common that we might be able to look towards or think about. So instead of doing an event about the Black radical tradition as such, this event is about kind of the concept of freedom and how art forms engage with notions of freedom and how the Black radical tradition thinks about that, but also how we might think about that here, what that means to us today, whether we have different notions, similar notions, how we're implicated in similar kind of struggles or ideas. So I'm really, really pleased to be starting the weekend with Norbessie and her poem. A really important thing for us, I suppose, is to, in reading that poem, and they'll talk about it a lot, you know, and I would encourage you all to ask any questions at any point, but a really important thing for us is to think about the situatedness of what it means to read that poem here today, how Glasgow might historically have been implicated in the slave trade, how our notions of freedom or confinement might resonate with things within the poem. I know Norbessie has plans to read it on different places along the slave route, so I think that, you know, it's very, it's a really great way to get into the weekend. So I'm rattling on too much, so I guess what I would say is that Norbessie's going to read a piece of the poem to start with, and then Fred will join her, we'll have a conversation. I'd really encourage you all to engage with that. If you have any questions at any point, please just ask. And I guess all of this is building towards a performed reading of the poem on Sunday, where the whole audience will be encouraged to read the poem together. We can talk about that a little bit later on. So without kind of rattling on too much, so I'll now sort of slink away. Thank you very much for coming, and I'll hand you over to Norbessie.
Thank you all very much. Thank you, Barry. Thank you, Fred, Emily, Ash, John, people who have been in touch with over the last several months. It's a real honor to be here. I've never been to Glasgow or Scotland. We drove through some years ago going on the way to Ireland. My daughter was into Celtic dancing and wanted to go to Ireland. I'm going to give you a very quick, precede background, and then I'll read a few pages from the poem, because I think it's important before Fred and I get into the conversation, so you have a sense of how it sounds and what I was trying to do. I think the first thing I want to say about the poem is that it's imperfect and unfinished. That's really important, and I think our conversation, you'll find out more about what I mean by that. I first came upon the story several years ago in a book written by James Walvin, an English academic, who talked about the ship, the Zong, that was coming across the Atlantic with a cargo of 470 slaves and some crew and enslaved Africans fell ill, and the captain believed that because of the way insurance law was at that time, if he threw overboard a certain number of enslaved Africans, it would allow for the owners of the ship to collect the insurance monies. I was absolutely astounded by this because I thought I knew a lot about slavery. I did study law, practiced law for 7 years, and so when I read it, I filed it away, and one of the things I say quite often is that I've gone through three stages of why I went into law. One was because my father wanted to do law. One was because I had a child to support. When I was working on this poem, I thought this was why I studied law. But I also had to leave law to do it. I do believe that. So when I went to the law library looking for the case, I found a simple two-page decision. Lord Mansfield was the Chief Justice who sat on it. And I photocopied that and somehow over time came up with the idea that I wanted to make some poems about this particular incident and that I would lock myself, I would limit myself to just using the words that appeared in this case report. So very quickly what happens, they throw the Africans overboard, they offload the rest of the enslaved Africans in Jamaica, go back to Liverpool, make a claim against the insurance company. The insurance company, the Gregsons, say no, we're not going to pay you for your destroyed, because you destroyed your own property. The ship's owners take them to court. The court says, yes, you must pay them. The Gregsons then appeal that decision, and before Lord Mansfield, they are granted a new trial. Now, the trail goes cold. We don't know if a trial was ever held. No one has ever reported a new trial. But the two-page document I talk about gives them the right to have a new trial. So that's what I limit myself to. And then over the years, I decided I was going to break and enter the text. And so that generates another four books where I use the words of that text. So for instance, if there's a word like captain, I will pull certain words out of that, like in, cap, tin, and so on, and then fashion poems from that. So that very briefly, and I know I've gone very quickly, but we'll talk more about it, is how I fashioned this book. I should also tell you that I made these dictionaries with the master or mother word and the words that I would get from each word. And then an interesting process begins to happen. Little stories begin to surface in the margins of the dictionary. That's how the poem actually wrote itself. It wasn't that I then found these words and then sat down and tried to compose it. I would just see things sort of coming together, you know? And so that's how the poem wrote itself. So what I'm going to do is read about four pages from different sections, so you get a sense of what's happening. There's also one other thing I want to say to you. When you look at the text in your hands, you'll see that the layout is quite unusual. There was one rule I followed here. So the first section, os, that's the section where I only use the words as they appear in that court report. The other sections, sal, ventus, ratio, ferrum, those are the words that come out of the mother words. The one rule I followed for those sections is that no word or cluster of words must come below another, directly below another. They're all, each word or cluster of words is searching for the space above. And it was that that gave the poem the form that you see there now. And that I would only use words that I found either as they exist or as I pulled out of other words. So the work is often described as a conceptual work, and I can see why it is, but in discussion I'll tell you why I think it's more than that as well, or other than that, or in addition to that. I think I've covered everything. So I'm going to read Zong 2, 3, and 4. Let's see what numbers I picked here. Oh, you have 3 and 4 there. You will hear me call some names out. At one point in this, I decided I wanted to name those who had been thrown overboard. There were 150 people, but it's a slippery signifier. The number changes. Sometimes it's 130, 140. No one seems to know the exact number.
And so these names are names that I chose. These names don't appear in that legal document that I talked to you about, that I've talked to you about. Zong number two. The throw in circumstance. The wait in want. In sustenance. For underwriters. The loss. The order in destroy. For that fact. The it was. The world. Negroes. The after rains. Waffle. Yao. Siolo. Bolade, Kibibi, Kamau, song number three, the sum of Negroes over board, the rest in lives, drowned. Exist did not. In themselves. Preservation. Obliged. Frenzy. First for 40 others. Etc. Nobini. Zezir. Ya. Issa. Cambodia. Zone number four. This is not was. Or should be. This be. Not should be. This should not be is Le Papuiche Aziza Chipo Dada Nomsa. I'll read page 65 and then I'll read one page from the last section, Ferran. Page 65, which is from South. And you'll see the rhythm changes here somewhat. Stars in Sidera, as there is ratio in rations, but why Ruth? Do the stars shine? If only murder made us, you were by my side. Us. Us, us, bow, namen, misfortunes, very new, and we map uncommon, the usual, to me, to the vessel, winds and currents. We ground upon. I pen this to you when I am her able paps her dugs. Her teats. Leak in necessity. There. Was sin a good? Supply of. Ply the Negroes with toys, lure them, visions of L, ace for a queen, my queen, there is pus. Just read from a page from the last section. This section actually is a section where I felt for the first time that I discovered my own language. Because as the work, language degrades throughout the work, and by the time I get to Ferum, as I fragment the words, I can hear underneath these English words, I hear another language. It was the first time in all the years I've been writing that I felt, and that my language was this broken thing on my phantom tongue, to quote Nate Mackey, phantom limb. But you'll see what I'm grappling with here. Ife fo ile, ife afa, ear trade eye, toe was li, chair mice, arts and shop, it ho fe, et flit ho, e and the re we you say will, s and spit, e rose high, p, t at the man, say sco, ness with j, and your st, p may theirs, ools rise from t, hey ha, de water, they be, in the row, ots and roo, bzz, bone, see, lean so moo, cheat, sun's bay, am's a story moo, stabia its way, ait a la, s of tens, he was t, ooh, thin be, e foul we bree, d then b, ed them e, they bow, oot tight, hem ayud, ame ed, moi crad, let to know, ava, il pas the en, egro pe, stagna, topen and s, ift the t, me so the ta, res of s, in tears of nay, grows brok, ibs all row, and it bro, oops the ka, ulach, shh, arm and ah, urk of sue, lose under wa. Ata we give all. Durs they star, re for. Rum the, raw de bon. Es dem my, hope a spi, re to the. A sky we give, ve the bon. Es order what? Is she but? My story it die. Is in Tim. A and within this tale, time D. Eyes from ton is stuff so. Fine your eyes, ill shine my D. Ere I have M, S, or th. Hey, thank you.
Fred Moulton, and just very briefly, I would say that I came to this poem, to Zong, as from sort of two different directions that eventually needed to meet. So one was as a reader of poetry, and as a lover of poetry, and as, and I guess I should say maybe more generally, a lover of experimental, of I guess what I would call experimental art. And in particular, I guess you could say maybe like a lover of experimental Black art, or let's say that the art that emerges in relation to what Barry was referring to as a Black radical tradition, sort of Afro-diasporic tradition of experimentation with form. And this is a tradition which has a kind of double edge, because on the one hand, you know, there's this tremendous necessity for experimentation as a response to a kind of brutal set of conditions under which people have to live. But the double edge is that the brutal conditions under which people have to live could also be talked about as an experiment. The, you know, the story of the African diaspora is like it's a science story, or it's a science fiction story, depending on how you want to look at it. So having a kind of a desire for art that just on a certain kind of basic level kind of looks and sounds and feels like this, like it's got this kind of question to it, or secret to it, strangeness or difference to it that seems appropriate to the situation. So it just seems to me, for me at least, it was always kind of stuff that I gravitate to. But I was also coming at it as a teacher, wanting to teach this book to students who maybe don't have the same impulse or attraction to this kind of work. So from both perspectives, the fundamental question was really, how are we supposed to read this book? And that question becomes more intense the further you get into the book, when you get into that last section, Farum, and it feels like words are disappearing, like they're running from you, like you're trying to make stuff out and you can't. It really makes this question of how to read it, this material, a real material question. So anyway, that's just a kind of preface, not to anything actually, but just to let you know that these were the sort of two directions from which I was coming at the book. So really all I want to do is ask Norbessie a bunch of questions, just like a kind of fantasy, you know, for me. And I think maybe the first question that I'll ask has to do precisely with this sense of what it means to feel the need to experiment as a way of, you know, where the impulse comes from. You talk about this as a story that can't be told. And at the same time, this story that can't be told was told to you. So I guess I'm interested in how it is that maybe the experimental impulse could be said to come from the difficulty of having to tell a story that can't be told.
Okay. I thought I was going to ask you questions too. I think what I mean by that was that when I began to work on this, I realized we can never tell the story of slavery. It's too huge. We can never ever know it. And so whatever we do, we're just getting bits and pieces of it. So that was the first awareness I had. Now, in terms of experimentation, I don't consider this experimentation. It's like what you say in your writings. I mean, for me, this is a way, I feel very strongly that this is how I make sense. When I went into this work, like the central question was, how do I make meaning of something that appears to have no meaning? What meaning can I apply to
not 10 years, not 100 years, but 500 years of bodies being taken across the ocean and dumped. Is there meaning to it? Is it simply that as a human being, you know, I think this impulse of trying to understand phenomena is pretty basic. So how do I, is there any meaning to it? And that first section, I think, really grapples with this sense of, almost a sense of unmeaning. There is no meaning to this beyond just the words in the document. And so, for me, I don't think what I do is experimentation, although I know people say that. For me, it's very much a part of trying to grapple with things that are often beyond me, and that this is the only way that I can express what is presented to me, because the conventional way isn't. For instance, in She Tries Her Tongue, two books before this, people often said that the work was postmodern. And yes, I agree with that. But one of the things I always added was that it's postmodern if you understand that the Caribbean was postmodern before the term was coined. Because all the qualities, bricolage, code switching, all those kinds of things are very much part of that, for me, that Caribbean experience, which is where I come from, Trinidad and Tobago. So you have, I say the Caribbean is a site of massive interruptions, where you have the European discourse, the African discourse, Asia, First Nations, they're all colliding like tectonic plates, often fatally. And out of this, somehow, and for me, to try and write that in this logical, linear way, top down, left to right, it seemed to me that that was doing the experience a second kind of violence. That what I had to do was to find a form that allowed all these contradictions to hang out on the page. Of course, it then becomes virtually impossible for me to read it as a sole reader. But that's how I would attempt to answer that question.
See, but everything you just said is what I think I mean when I say experiment. It's like this great philosopher of science, Paul Feyerabend, and he wrote this book called Against Method.
Mm-hmm.
Basic argument is that, you know, we go to school and we learn that, you know, the great advances in science and knowledge and sort of West and the Enlightenment are a function of people adhering in this very strict way to a so-called scientific method. And Feyerabend is like, a lot of that stuff happens by accident, right? There is no sort of straight linear method. What there is is a kind of, you know, eruptive moment of part accident, part inspiration,
mm-hmm.
which sort of obliterates an already existing paradigm, you know? And these accidents kind of happen. It's just like the conceptual thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like Engels makes... Sorry, I'm being all professorish, but this is a distinction that authors makes between like the production of a concept and the discovery of a concept, you know? Like the alchemists, you
mm-hmm.
know, they blew up all kinds of stuff trying to make gold out of whatever. And they didn't make gold, but they did make oxygen, right? They just didn't have a theory of oxygen, right? So they're blowing everything up and they find somebody like, oh, there's something called oxygen. Ooh, you know? That the discovery of oxygen is like, it's a tremendously important moment in the history of science, but nobody intended to discover it, right? It was produced by accident, and then a concept of oxygen was formulated. And to me, it's conceptual in that way,
mm-hmm.
right? It's like, you know, you live in a situation which places you under these brutal constraints, you know? The tectonic shifts you're talking about are shifts that are happening when you're in between the plates,
mm-hmm.
right? And in the face of that, yeah, there is this absolute necessity of making.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not even, as you said, not making a poem, not making a work of art, not making sense, just making sense. Right? As if making was like the one last bit of contact that you could have, right, to being human, you know, in the face of this brutal dehumanization. And then, and that ends up being, in this very cool way, I don't know if that's a story, but that's part of what it is that this poem then, see, that was why it was so cool for me to try to teach this to my students, and I learned all this stuff too. Because I think they kind of, they also reached the limit in terms of trying to figure out how to make sense of it.
Mm-hmm.
Like they couldn't, you see what I'm saying? So you're trying to make sense of this experience, they're trying to make sense of a poem, and then they had, and in that moment, there was a kind of kinship.
Exactly.
That was, you know, how do I deal with this? Put them in a position that maybe was, well, certainly uncomfortable, and in the face of it, they made stuff. They made things.
Are you dubbing? This is like a, I mean, dubbing like music, because that's what it seems to be for me. You take the existing things, you take that part, you put on a delay, and you make a new rhythm with it. This is like an approach that seems like doesn't make sense.
Does it
make sense to see it like this? Because it's,
I would say so, yes, I think so. Yeah. Is that what it seems like to you?
Yeah. It was a bit, yeah, especially when you came like in the end to your own melody, it was like this totally new thing out of the smallest parts.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It helped me to understand. I think I understood something.
Okay. I mean, one of the things, sorry, go ahead. No.
I was going to say, outside of the fact of information there, I think the way that everyone can receive this should probably be different.
Exactly.
And that whatever comes of it, the way in which they pass it on to whomever they're passing it to, should also be different. Because I think that the experience of distance and time,
mm-hmm.
and also the difference between individuals,
mm-hmm.
and their particular
mm-hmm.
way of moving through the planet,
mm-hmm.
all this stuff is different.
Mm-hmm.
And we often imply a bigger meaning to something that has multiple meanings.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you cannot gather them all in one pot.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I think that I'm experiencing through this poetry.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
I was thinking about,
No, go ahead. Well, would you remember that?
Yeah, I remember.
I think part of my resistance to the use of the word experimental, although I agree with you, I don't think we have a disagreement about what is actually happening,
mm-hmm.
is that somehow there's a sense that experimental is temporary and that there is a point at which you will discover the real thing,
mm-hmm.
which I resist, that the experiment is what it is, or that life in and of itself is an experiment. Sorry.
No, we agree.
Yeah.
I agree with that. And I wanted to take like a different, it's not disconnected, but I was thinking about something Barry was saying in the beginning about the relevance of this work for here and now,
mm-hmm.
in Glasgow. And I was thinking about that today in the hotel, and I was, you know, I have to admit, almost complete ignorance about Glasgow. It's the first time I've been here too. I'm trying to just get some sense of where I am in the world, and also to try to get some sense, okay, well, certainly thinking through certain resonance and relation that Glasgow has to, you know, to the Atlantic slave trade and to the sort of historical events that the poems are working through or working out of, and reading, trying to, you know, just find some stuff online about it. But then I started kind of thinking about it in a different way in relation to this question of relevance, you know. Something that I think is really important, and which I also think this poem is requiring us to consider, is that the middle passage is, you know, what it encompasses are some very brutal and specific acts that were perpetrated by particular people on particular other people. And that's, it's not that that's not true, but the middle passage is something that happened to the world, right? It's like a world event. It's like this catastrophic world event that happened to everybody. And maybe the horrible sort of extension of the middle passage was the capacity that people in power had to convince most of the people in the world that it didn't have anything to do with them. Right? So you sort of read these essays in the newspaper about how folks are saying that Glasgow needs to create a monument to talk about its role in the slave trade. And then, of course, you do the kind of crazy thing and look at the comments underneath, which are always scary. You know, of course we knew that there was slavery, but, you know, this is a question of fiscal responsibility and whatever, you know. But I guess what I'm trying to get at is, how is it that what's interesting to me about this poem, what's interesting to me precisely about the question of how to read this poem is that it brings us right face to face with the notion and with the idea that the middle passage is an event that everybody is implicated in, and not at the too simplistic level of a simple opposition between victims and perpetrators.
Mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's like when we were walking up the street just here with John, mm-hmm. and we're talking about, you know, how do we talk about the effect and the impact of imperialism in Britain?
In Britain, yeah.
Right? As opposed to just outside of Britain. Mm-hmm. How do we talk about the effect of slave trade in Glasgow, and not just in that kind of narrative which tells us that the slave trade made Glasgow industrialization possible, mm-hmm. but how did the slave trade make a whole range of forms of deprivation of people's lives in Scotland possible? How did mm-hmm. it structure that?
Mm-hmm.
So again, it's all bound up with something that you talked about in an essay that Norbessie sent me that I wish everybody could have read, but the notion that what the poem becomes is a kind of ceremony
mm-hmm.
in which the living and the dead can talk, can arrange, can get together to organize the future. Right? So, sorry. For me, this is a question that I'm interested maybe in how we would address this question,
mm-hmm.
you know, not just us two, but everybody,
mm-hmm.
right? So one part of it is, how do we figure out ways to organize our future? But the other way is, like, how do we think about that specifically as a kind of ceremonial thing,
mm-hmm.
right? And to think about artistic practice as maybe one of the ways in which that kind of ceremonial thing can happen.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just like thinking, like, if you wanted to do something like that, then why would you even want to make sense to, like, a social order
mm-hmm.
that is, you know, that there's an important point about, like, so Nathaniel Matthews, a friend of, you know, we invited him, we couldn't come, but we can do stuff with him in the future. He has a concept of telling inarticulacy,
mm-hmm.
which is this idea of, in saying something that's inarticulate, there's still something within it that it's inarticulate to whom. There's the act of trying to articulate yourself, but who is it that you're trying to speak to, and who do you want to be heard by?
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps you don't want to be heard by a dominating social order, which has founded itself on a racism that you know that's been perpetrated for hundreds of years. So, like, this moment when I was listening to you read the last bit of that poem, where it's kind of like the last piece. I had a quote here from, like, Nathaniel when he's talking about Kamau Brathwaite. He talks about Brathwaite both announces the emergence of a new language and acknowledges the impediments to its emergence, going so far as to advance impediment as a constituent of the language's
mm-hmm.
newness.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
And so I thought
yeah.
that was, like, really this idea of, like, who is it articulate? If we were going to
yeah.
organise ourselves,
exactly.
do we want to be heard by
yeah.
certain
yeah.
people? Maybe we don't.
Yeah.
Maybe, you know, and this kind of, like, looking for a new language
yeah.
or the kind of
yeah.
the bits that are like phonic substance or something that doesn't
yeah.
make sense is
yeah.
really important.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I meant when I said, like, the language felt like my own, with the stuttering and the, you know, the mumbling and so
mm.
on. That is what I can claim
mm.
as my own language, and I think it fits with both what Braithwaite and Mackie were saying. One of the things we were saying today earlier when we were talking in the hotel and Emily was there is about that, you know, we talk about globalization, but this is not the first globalization.
there was the slave ship was a globalized unit. You had multi-ethnic, multi-racial, you know, the dead weight tonnage. It was, you know, you had Europeans, you had Arabs, you had Africans from all different ethnic groups. And I often say it was the globalization of the skin, because you could be transported anywhere in the world if you had a black skin, without a passport, nothing was necessary. That was the first globalization. And I think that today, we're also living, as Baucom argues in his book, we're living with the results of the speculative financing that came out of that particular trade, you know, where you could buy someone in West Africa and pay for them in Liverpool through a series of promissory notes. And so I think it's really important for us to, as Fred is saying, because we're living today, all of us, not just Africans or descendants of Africans, but all of us are living with the repercussions of that. And I'd just like to start
thinking about isn't the slavery, it's just one part of a whole series of brutalities. I mean, we've got to think about genocide. The genocide of the Aborigines, of the Maoris, of the Native Americans, and then more recently, the Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
There's all kinds of brutalities that are going on. And slavery is one of the most dramatic things, but there, well, nothing can be more dramatic than genocide, but there's a whole series
mm-hmm,
of things
mm-hmm,
which
mm-hmm.
Western civilization perpetrated. But I mean, there's a lot of things that opens up. But I liked what our friend here said.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering whether there was a question of your finding words inadequate, because you've been reading words which we could relate to.
Mm-hmm.
Then it became more sounds,
mm-hmm.
and in a way, I suppose, music is
mm-hmm.
how you described it.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder whether that was also a feeling of the inadequacy
mm-hmm.
was it, in the way that
absolutely
Beckett feels it
mm-hmm.
in the later words.
Mm-hmm.
And then
mm-hmm.
he goes on still using them.
Mm-hmm.
But you went a step further, you actually gave them up,
mm-hmm.
and you made him extremely expressive sounds which transcended
mm-hmm.
language,
mm-hmm.
but which Beckett couldn't do. The only way he did it was interesting, was to write in another language,
mm-hmm.
which gave him, he said, more freedom, because
mm-hmm.
I freed myself from style and from history in a way by writing
mm-hmm.
in French.
Mm-hmm.
But I like the way that it was very impressive, very moving, the way that you just translated, went off somewhere else, and it was moving and expressive
mm-hmm.
at the same time.
I think, thank you for that, but what I would say that it comes from a place of deep necessity. Do you
yeah.
know, it's not a not a style, it's
no.
that this
no.
is,
no, it's
yeah.
Is it akin to speaking in tongues? Is that something to do with? Is it something like that?
You know, the best answer to that is to say that when I was writing that section, I felt I was having my revenge on the English language that I have wanted to do for the longest while. And I remember sitting at the computer, and I don't know if this happens to you, when you're typing something and you know that you're excited about it, you hit the keys harder, you know, so I was like hitting these keys as I did this, because it felt like finally I was, you know, She Tries the Tongue has a poem, much anthologized, called Discourse on the Logic of Language, and there's a refrain, English is my mother tongue, is my father tongue, is a foreign land, language, languish, anguish, English is a foreign anguish. So that was 20 years ago. And I think that section is a response to that anguish.
Well, you know, it's foreign for us as well. I often, like, I listen
point
to what
taken. Yes.
An
yeah.
adverse. I have no idea what they're talking
yeah.
about.
Yeah.
No idea.
Yeah.
And it's a kind of the language of which I grew up with, the language of people like Thomas Hardy and Dickens and Shakespeare. That's something else now. It's been it's become a business language, language of power, more so,
yeah.
Even more so,
yeah.
Much more.
Yeah.
That, I must say, in this, the Russia, they, if they ask you, they will ask the question, do you speak American? Don't say, do you speak English? Which is in a way a compliment, I suppose.
Yeah.
It's somewhere else now. And I looked at my wife and I, do you know what they're saying? And I can't understand the language was supposed to be English.
Yeah.
So we're totally alienated from our own language,
mm-hmm.
so-called own language.
Do you think of it even more specifically as a revenge on legal language?
A revenge on the law, maybe. not legal language. No, I think it was more the English language and less legal language. Yeah, I think that's a whole other area that I think you want to get to. Yeah.
When you open a book and ready to recite, the spaces that you have carved into the structure,
mm-hmm.
You mark them by your expression. Or do you mark them by your visual connection with them?
Mm-hmm.
And is there any expectation of how they should be viewed other than the way you have structured them on the page?
Can I say something about before you answer that? Good, because I felt that on the page it was more interesting rhythmically than the way you spoke.
Mm-hmm.
Because it tended to denigrate into a kind of periodicity. The pauses tend to become the same.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't think consciously about that,
mm-hmm.
That's what happens. I was actually counting the seconds.
Oh, that's interesting,
I have
yeah.
to say.
Yeah.
And it didn't correspond to the page. It was quite arrhythmic.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened, I found that when I'm playing, improvising, that
mm-hmm.
if you don't, you're not conscious of it, you
mm-hmm.
can actually degrade into a kind of
mm-hmm.
periodicity. You say something and then you wait 5 seconds or seven and
yeah.
you're sending something
yeah.
else.
Yeah.
But that was something, not that it detracted from the enjoyment
yeah.
that I got from it, but I just noticed because as a musician I'm very conscious
no.
of that. I do it myself. You find that you it's easy to do that.
I think they're both very interesting points, and I'm looking here because for me, it took me a while to understand that I needed to, I say, honor the spaces. And there was, I began to realize that they worked almost like rest in music. And I, certainly in this first section, I don't think, you'll see, you can't see it from here, but you can actually see I'm sort of counting, I've put marks on the page, trying to figure out, well, do I count from there to there, or do I count as my eye goes like this?
Mm-hmm.
There's another one about the law that is even, I think everyone will be able to see that one. Where, you know, I've kind of drawn a grid over it to sort of figure out. So, best way to answer the question is I'm still working it out.
Okay.
I think the spaces drive the words instead of the words driving the spaces. I think what's happening, the pain is in the spaces, and that's where what's happening, particularly in this first section.
I was thinking particularly about the idea of ceremony.
Yeah.
Because in that kind of a context, everything is placed, you see.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so,
mm-hmm.
so going from one point to the next, if it gets there too fast or too slow,
exactly,
it not necessarily distorts the ceremony, but it makes it different.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So it's going to be interesting with the collective reading, because
mm-hmm.
people will read at different speeds,
mm-hmm.
and so something else begins to happen with that. With
Fred,
that,
I didn't finish.
I'm sorry.
I like to imply to you that the notion of rest,
erase that notion. Thank
and
you.
Use space.
Use space.
That's best what the poem is laid out. It is about space as opposed to
right.
rest.
Rest, okay.
Because rest is this kind of a metric or notion about something that's going on that way or that way.
Point taken.
Yeah, that's all.
For me, those breaks were about breath.
Huh?
For me, those breaks were about breath.
Well, how do you count breath?
Yeah, I was watching your body for it. That was the point where I was really in it somehow.
But the idea of breath also could carry you beyond the point of its contact, because if you got a large capacity, you may end up doing more, you know. So.
I was going to ask,
let's get some questions.
I wanted to ask you about the manner of you read the first bits of the poem, because like the words which are understandable to us were more disjuncted, there's more difficult to make sense out of them. Whereas the last bit, when you invented your own language, you kind of like make the links between the words. So like for me, it was like more it was easier to understand in terms of like expression.
Mm-hmm.
Was it a kind of like deliberate move to kind of like disjunct the words of like the language we can all understand and kind of like make more understandable this like new your language?
The last section? No, there wasn't any intention. No. I think I've been reading that last set, you know, as I hear more and more clearly this other language under there. And it's in the moment I decide if I see a C, do I say K or do I say C? If I see a T, do I say T or do I say T? And I just make the decisions. Tomorrow I might read it quite differently. So it wasn't intentional to make that last section more comprehensible than the first section. Not at all.
Fred, I was going to, or both of you actually, but like a concept that comes up in your book a lot is interim animation. And I wonder if you could like, maybe it's a word that I had to look up, I didn't know it before and stuff. And so it seems to be very much that's kind of what we're talking about now, the way in which words touch each other, the space between the words. I wonder if you'd like to say something to that, because I'd like to hear you kind of explain that like idea.
Well, that's a John Donne. It's from, I think it's The Good Morrow. It talks about love, so inter and animates two souls.
Mm-hmm.
It's a cool word, you know. Because what it implies is a kind of exchange of breath between two people. Neither one of whom could be said to actually breathe or to be animated without the other's
mm-hmm.
breath.
Mm-hmm.
So, for me, you know, it ends up being a kind of thing where it's asking you to think differently about kind of how you walk around on the earth every day. You know, I mean, I'm interested in it because it seems to, the way that term works in the poem is it kind of implies that the way love works in that poem is that, you know, it's not an experience that happens to some entity that we would call an individual, right? So it's basically kind of saying that the whole way the way we think about personhood is kind of got to be bracketed and set aside, and we need a new way thinking about what it means to be a person, or to be matter of fact, you can't even say be a person. It's more like you have to kind of say, we got to think about what it means to be involved in personhood. It's you know, so it's a term, it's a word that kind of pushes you, you know, in a certain kind of direction. And I'm especially interested in it because it feels to me like it's doing something which is very much like what Norvesi is doing constantly in this poem. Like, so I wish I could take a picture of that.
You can.
I will. show it the next time I teach the book. See, basically what happened was we had to sit down. We were trying, when I say that we had to figure out how to read the book, I mean it like in this really literal way. Not we had to figure out how to interpret the book and write essays on it. We had to figure out how to read it in the same way that you're still figuring out
mm-hmm.
how to read it, where read is performed, as if it were a score,
mm-hmm.
right? You're treating it as if it were a score,
mm-hmm.
and these are your notations,
mm-hmm.
performance notations. But the cool thing was is that before we could figure out how to read it, we had to figure out how we were going to figure out how to read it. So basically, the class became a we had to organize ourselves, right? The work made us, we had to organize ourselves in ways that did not correspond to the normal rules and sort of temporal arrangements of the class at room at the place where I was teaching. And that's the cool thing for me about the poem at the level of, you know, so what if we think that a certain kind of encounter with the middle passage, a knowing encounter with the middle passage, which is one of, as John was saying, one of many historical catastrophes which we are all involved in. But let's say that we decide we're going to encounter this one, and we encounter it in such a way that it requires us to organize ourselves differently. And I think that's what Dunn is saying in that, with entering. He's like, it's like, okay, this is a different kind of love, right? Because I have to organize all my shit totally differently now, basically. And I got to do something different, you know? So much so, in fact, that I can't even really say I anymore, mm-hmm. right? That's, which therefore means I got to come up with an entirely new kind of conceptual language mm-hmm. in order to be able to understand what I used to call my existence on Earth, you know? So when experience puts that kind of pressure on you, it becomes possible to, well, it becomes both possible and also at the same time necessary to make, mm-hmm. which is to say, including make the world again, make it new, make it different.
But so I think that that's very interesting in terms of like just what you're saying. I'm just thinking about like the social or the social implications of form or something mm-hmm. within a poem. So interim animation in like a poetry or writing critical, just purely critical style thing. It just means like the space between the words and how words touch each other or something. But so that could be very dry, be very academic, and just looking at how words are placed together and how one. Mm-hmm. How like something and another one, and you know, brings out a different element or something, a different level of meaning. But it can be very dry. I think what you're talking about is like looking at the social, political, communal kind of implications of something that is treated normally as abstract and formal. And mm-hmm. I find that you know that's.
Well, no, but you talk about the spaces as spaces of encounter, right?
Yes. Yeah, so where I see resonances with what Fred is saying in terms of the form is that remember I said in the beginning. The relational is integral to the four books coming after Ars because each phrase is in relation to another phrase or word, and each cluster or word is seeking that space above. So there's a deep structure of relationship and the relational and interanimation within the text itself, and which takes us to what you're saying about even I has to disappear. Hence the title, the book says, as told to the author by someone else. And I just want to add that it came in a roundabout way, this collective reading. I heard that Fred had come up with this reading, this collective reading, when I was doing a reading in New York a couple of years ago. And as soon as the person told me, she said, oh, has Fred told you what he's doing? I said, no, I don't know. But you see, that for me confirms something about what we're talking about here, because there's something about the ego standing aside and allowing other people to help me complete this work, which is, as I say, imperfect and unfinished, and will always be unfinished, and will always be imperfect.
I was going to save this line for like when I speak to Fred later, but there's a really great, in an email he sent me a really great quote from Edward Glissant, which is like talking about the point of departure, you know, when a ship would leave, and the line was, it's the moment when one consents not to be a single being and attempts to be many beings at the same time.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
You know, that seems,
yeah.
I mean, I'm going to still use that word, that speak to Fred later, but
that
seems
yeah.
exactly what you're
yeah.
talking about.
Yeah, we'd been talking about that today. Yeah, very much so. Someone had a hand up at the back.
Yeah, thank you. I much like what Fred was saying, I remember the first time that I encountered this work and had no idea what to make of it. But I'm curious about like this repeated attempt to try to name an experience, can't be named at the time that you're writing, because like you were talking about before, of course, Ian Malcolm uses parts of your poem in the epigraphs to Specters of the Atlantic in several chapters. And at the same sort of moment that you're writing, Kara Walker has her first exhibit in the Tate Modern, I think, in Liverpool with Rub for Sharks, sort of response to J.M.W. Turner's Slaves Thrown Overboard. And then in around 2005, or so around that same time, there's a play that's staged for the first time in Ireland by Liz Coody called The Sugar Wife, where a female, it's a sort of interesting take on globalization, all of these sort of African-American ex-slaves arrive in Ireland in 2005 in some pretty wild ways to sort of think about Celtic Tiger and asylum-seeking, all the rest. But it was a complicated play where a female ex-slave comes to Ireland with her Quaker lover who originally bought her at an auction, really complicated. But it's punctuated, this naturalism is punctuated by her standing on the stage by herself, telling the story of her great-grandmother's experiences on the slave ship Zong. The play takes place in about 1850 on that. And the only way it can sort of be named is through a sort of carnival, over-the-top, grotesque sense of, did this happen? You know, where we absolutely know that we're involved in a fiction. And at the same time, much like Fred was just talking about, there's a way in which those scenes to me mark a way that a sort of contemporary kinship takes place with the dead. That there's a way that we can remake experience. So I guess my question was really, I just thought it was just sort of fascinating how it migrates across different mediums in that attempt to try to name it. But as you're looking at the legal documents, if you were also sort of in conversation with these other kinds of visual or critical or theatrical mediums that are trying to also create a different kind of space within their own aesthetic, experimental aesthetic. Mm-hmm.
You want me to go with that? I think one of the best way to come at that would be to say that because I had studied law and practiced law, I understood that what I was seeing, that two-page case report, was actually based on, as cases move up, all the messy parts, the human parts get squeezed out until you get a very dry thing, you know. Was this murder, or did they have the right to throw overboard their property, so to speak? And I knew, just from having read hundreds of cases, that the stories were locked in this. But it's interesting, because the Zong has always been marked by these lacunae, you know, they never found the ship's log, and so on. So that these gaps are very much a part of the context of the story. And so it there's a sense in which the gaps in even in the form that I've used mirror that, yes. But it was actually coming more from that rather than from other media. But it was this conviction that the stories were in there. How was I going to get at those stories? At the same time, becoming more and more aware that I couldn't ever get at it. It would never be told. It had to be told. I could never tell it, but I had to make it somehow. Yeah. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
There was one part I was really interested in, which came in the Zong 4, where you're clearly describing an ongoing event. You're saying this is not
exactly
not what's,
yeah.
I mean, are you referring explicitly to the kind of this ceremonial term that's popping up? I mean, are you referring to something like this, for example? I mean, what is this ongoing event?
The ongoing event is that I think Zong continues to repeat itself. The resonances, it's like, you know, the pebble drops, that it continues, that it's not history. It is history, but it is also present.
You wouldn't want to see it be relegated to history.
Exactly, yeah. And I mean, I could break it down into, you know, political things, but
there's a sense in which I'm saying that this event remains in the present with us, or with me at least,
mm-hmm.
in a way that that leads me to write this is, not was. Yeah. Is that?
Yeah, no.
I will get to the ceremony part of it as well. Oh, this question.
It was just a question about the names. You mentioned them briefly. That you did pull them from a particular, they weren't listed and whatnot. And I'm sort of coming at this as a history student, we've been studying the slave trade from special subjects, so we've been going through statistics and
mm-hmm.
stories, and like you were saying, slavery is not something that can be learned, it's a, you know, you take bits here and there and try and piece it together. What we struggle with is trying not to see it as a statistic and as, you know, you're hearing millions upon thousands of people, you know, but how did you, where did the names come from, and like, you know, was there, were there certain names you were drawn to, or how did they
mm-hmm.
sort of?
Well, the first thing I did was to call James Walvin himself to ask him if he had the names. Now, in the preface to his book, he does say, it's interesting what you're saying, that he was writing the work Black Ivory with a view to moving away from that statistical approach to telling the history of the slave trade. He wanted to, you know, I suppose, put the human back into what was going on. I did call him and he said no. And as he answered me, I realized that it was a stupid question because they never kept names. It was Negro man, Negro woman, and so on. And so what I did was to pull names from, because the trade pulled on all of Africa, not just West Africa. You know, there were trade fairs that, you know, coming down the east coast of Africa, Central Africa. I always thought it was only West Africa, but in Tobago, for instance, there's a lot of names and Congo influences from Central Africa. So it pulled on the entire continent. So I just found as many names as I could that sort of, also wanted to include some Muslim names as well, because that was part of it, to sort of represent that. It was just a part of, it's part of the ceremonial as well, like the naming of those who were lost. Is that?
Yeah.
To me, that question really resonates in this cool way with the beginning of Zong number 3. Because when you hear it, and I noticed too in reading about the Zong, that the number of people who were thrown overboard always changes.
Mm-hmm.
It's never precise. And it's as if it's like this kind of, it's as if the incalculability of it kind of maintains itself right there, right? Like, you can't count this. But that phrase, the sum of Negroes,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, where you can also read S-U-M, sum,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
say that, you know, in a lot of ways, the poem begins with that, or, you know, very early on in the poem, we get that phrase, and everything else that's going on in the poems is a kind of, is remarking the resistance to being calculated in that way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I imagine that also has a kind of musical implication too, right? You know, I think maybe that thing of this thing not being countable in that way
mm-hmm.
corresponds to what Rada was saying.
What was, yeah, in terms of rest and so on.
Yeah.
Were you conscious of that, the sum of Negroes, that it could be heard as the S-U-M of sum of Negroes, S-U-M rather than S-O-M-E?
You mean like when I wrote it?
No, just for people listening.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you thought that, but you meant that, and well, it's not really.
I didn't, well, because I was just using the words as they existed in the text.
You get that sort of thing in the English, don't you? Where say a word like pray.
mm-hmm.
In other words like that, which you get, you hear it, you get the complete wrong end of the stick.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it's, I was glad you brought up read it I word, you know, I think I do. I mean, that's the ultimate kind of word, isn't it? The I word. I think, what's that, I? What that mean, I think? when I get up there, I don't think anything. Well, where does it come from? I think this. What is this? It's all kinds of things that makes you think about it. I in a completely different way, I guess. That I guess the Buddhists get closer to that than we do.
Mm-hmm.
We just think about, when you say I do, I make, I think. Think what that actually means. What am I thinking? Where does it come from?
Mm-hmm.
My parents, my teachers, my experience, all kinds of things. You know, what value does it have to say I think this?
I think that meaning is a very strange journey to go on. I think experience is probably more correct, and it's definitely more lasting, because how we experience whatever we're involved in, it stays with us forever. It informs a lot of decisions we make, even though we're not present or conscious in our present, how we're making them. And I would think that this is a performance that is meant in every sense of the word to convey something that's greater than any one of us can actually perceive at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at one time for ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that probably, at least I like to think this about when I perform, it's not necessary really to use this word about understanding and stuff like that in relationship to it, because the experience itself will carry the impact of what that performance was without anybody in between helping you make this decision about what it meant to you.
Mm-hmm.
So our experiences as we journey across this thing, even when we put the most basic resistance against something like the I word we're talking about, you still can use that I word and not be convinced that that I word is talking about yourself. You can use it in an entirely different way.
I agree with Kaji. You said nothing is more boring than self-expression. What, you know, a better word would be self-invention. That's dynamic. You know, I don't want to be to express, but I want to change it, do something different, better. It's not self-expression. Expression gets nowhere. It's a cul-de-sac. You hear that in music, it's just like in any other art.
I was just saying, thinking what you were saying about the kind of being in some ways being an early form of postmodernism, and would you say there's a link in what you try to do to say certain traditions from Jamaica? I was thinking some conversations here might be a bit of word sound, where like the English language is kind of deconstructed, so for example, system was turned into shit stem, and also like I was I and I. So it couldn't be, it wasn't such a singularity, it always had to be, like in language, you can't, there's no point, you couldn't just speak language singularly, there has to be a response kind of thing.
Yeah, so, I think that's what, I mean, when Fred, when you talked early on about experimentation, and I talked about the fact that I mean, you talk about Rasta language. I mean, that's their way of trying to grapple with this thing that's presented to them, you know, so they develop a different kind of orthography and different ways. They don't say understand, they say overstand and so on. Again, you know, because they're trying to create a certain universe that makes sense to them, shits them and so on. So, yeah, and I think that's part of what we have had to do, the kind of work that we've had to do always to maintain some kind of balance in a system whose intent is to erase you completely. Yeah?
I think everybody has to do that.
Yeah.
I just think that over the course of history, you know, the I has a history. You know, in other words, it's cool, we can talk about the emergence of Rasta language and the I and I and say, well, we know some of where this comes from, some of the context out of which this emerges. But I think that I, and that the notion of a kind of single, absolutely self-contained and self-determined and self-possessed I, that's got a history too. And I think that history is like all bound up with the slave trade.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, the slave trade kind of helps that eye come into relief as a delusion that people can believe
mm-hmm,
in
mm-hmm.
against the grain of their own experience, which is constantly undermining it, right? But, you know, so the question then becomes, well, who is it that, what happened? Something happened somewhere along the line. The experience that we have of working against the grain of the brutal limitations of that kind of thinking that we all engage in every day just to live,
mm-hmm.
you know? Like just when you're sitting at dinner and you say, pass the peas, right, or salt. That's, you know, I always thought that was like kind of a perfect expression of communism, you know, that even, you know, George Bush would do, you know. So, but like if you, when you do that, you know, how do you, you know, if you've been kind of raised and trained up to live a normal life so that you can become a responsible I, you know, how do you, what do you do with that experience? Where does it go? How do you disavow it, you know? And it seems to me that, and at the same time, if that experience is disavowed, if it's projected onto some other people, they're the ones who do that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They're the ones who are not quite responsible enough to be a real I. They can't control their appetites, you know? They can't control their emotions,
mm-hmm.
you know? They can't really think in a rational way, you know? They're the ones who can't really be an I. So you relegate it, you disavow it to those people. Oh, it really becomes easy if their skin, if they look different, right?
Mm-hmm.
If they got different skin or different sexual organs, whatever, right? You relegate it to them, you disavow it and you relegate it to them. And then in this weird way, it's precisely those people who become, as it were, you know, the guardians of precisely this other structure of experience that
mm-hmm.
you have that normal life has tried to disavow. It's not essential to them anymore, or I should say it's no more essential
mm-hmm.
to them than it is to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that they have been the ones who have been, you know, it's like that's the cherry on the top, you know, so to speak, of slavery. It's like, you know, in addition to like having to live, you know, in this totally inhuman way, you also have to become the guardians of like
mm-hmm.
humanity,
mm-hmm.
you know, right? I mean, it's like, that's a bad trick, you know? I mean, who wants to be that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Who wants to, you know, who wants to be the guardian of humanity, right? I mean, you
yeah.
see it all the time, though, you know?
Yeah.
The same people who will say that these are the absolutely most degraded people, you know, even like Kipling, like Kim, you know? Those books are constantly produced by this double move where you sort of say, these people are subhuman, except for this one, who actually is the essence of the human, right? You know? So what I'm saying is everybody is figuring out this kind of fugitive experimental relation to get past the brutal kind of deprivation and imposition, you know, of that I, you know, what you lose by becoming
mm-hmm.
a responsible I.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's trying to get that back, it seems to me.
I think what it produces is basically a schizophrenia, which the whole country suffers. Oh, country, there was a debate yesterday or the day before in Parliament when this woman actress got up and said, I was taught about that greed was bad and selfishness was bad and using your elbows and your arms and your legs was bad. All these things were bad. Now I realize that is wrong. You know? It wasn't that. These are actual virtues.
Mm-hmm.
These are virtues. Greed is a virtue. Selfishness is a virtue. Ambition is a virtue. And people actually, it drives you crazy, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Most people live this schizophrenic existence. You go to work, you use something you know in your heart is bullshit. Or is that against people? It actually harms people, what you do. If you give yourself 1 minute, 2 minutes, to think, what am I actually doing? What is what I do? How does what I do affect people? You go crazy. I remember there was an interview with a governor of a big prison in London. I happened to catch it on the radio, and he was talking about mental illness, people that are really just mentally ill, they're not criminals. And he said, well, how many people do you think need this? Your prisoner suffered from this. He said, well, I would say 98%. 98%, you're absolutely right.
It's the same, like, again, it's like another concept, like, from Nathaniel Mackie, this notion of discrepant engagement. So that's, so like, it's, maybe you guys could talk about that, because again, you know a lot more about it than me, but like, if I, like, read it from Nate, mm-hmm. then it's the discrepancy between presumed norms, so that's what we're talking about, like the kind of, like, the social mm-hmm. norms that press down on us, and the qualities of experience that such norms fail to accommodate. That's this notion of discrepant engagement. I wonder, like, that's what we're talking about, isn't it?
Yep.
End to the conversation, sorry.
No.
If I could, Fred, you mentioned the whole aspect of the ceremonial, and I wonder if you could just give me a second here. This is the piece, that essay that Fred's referring to, and I'll just read a section. George Lamming, the Barbadian novelist, in his collection, The Pleasures of Exile, he talks about this particular ceremony he observed called the Ceremony of Souls. And I read it again recently, and I was really struck by how much it applied to what we're talking about here. He said, in the Republic of Haiti, he writes, one corner of the Caribbean cradle, a native religion sometimes forces the official law, capital L, to negotiate with peasants who have retained a racial and historic desire to worship their original gods. The Ceremony of Souls is regarded by the Haitian peasant as a solemn communion, for he hears at first hand the secrets of the dead. The celebrants are mainly relatives of the deceased who, ever since their death, have been locked in water. It is the duty of the dead to return an offer on this momentous night, a full and honest report on their past relations with the living. It is the duty of the dead to speak, since their release from the purgatory of water cannot be realized until they have fulfilled the contract with the ceremony, which the ceremony symbolizes. The dead need to speak if they're going to enter that eternity, which will be their last and permanent future. And the part that really fascinates me is where he says, different as they may be in their present state of existence, the dead and the living, those alive and those now dead, their ambitions point to a similar end. They're interested in their future. And you and I were talking about this today, that there's a sense in which we, the readers, the audience, mm-hmm. like the dead, are interested in the future, because the future depends on what we make of this present.
But I was thinking about this so much in teaching a poem and talking with other students about it, and I think I probably spoke in a way that was too extreme, in the sense that I was like, just maybe on a rhetorical point, I would be like, this poem is about the future, mm-hmm. right? Song is about the future, and I think it's more precise by way of this, your essay, and by way of what Lamming is saying.
Mm-hmm.
This is a poem in which the living and the dead commune in order to organize the future,
mm-hmm.
to envision and to organize
mm-hmm.
for the future.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this is, that's, to me, that's like a really deep thing.
Yeah.
And
which gets to your point about the present. This is,
the ceremony thing is, I was, again, I mean, I tend to, you know, my first thought is always like, I think about it in these sort of oppositional ways, but I know it's not that easy. But I do think, at least on a sort of preliminary way, about the ceremonial as very, the ceremony is a very different kind of thing than the tribe.
Yes.
Right? So Mansfield, what we do know is that he approves another tribe. That's what we're left with.
Mm-hmm.
It's something almost like the endless specter of another tribe,
mm-hmm.
which to me is purgatorial,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
They,
mm-hmm.
Those people are continually left
mm-hmm.
on trial. and the ceremony ends that trial, right? The ceremony disrupts the legal process,
mm-hmm.
right? See, for me now, I would want to say that the ceremony disrupts the legal process, but not in a way that, because you talk in the essay about abandoning the law in
right.
order to write the poem, and what I would want to say is like the ceremony disrupts the legal process,
mm-hmm.
not so much that the law is abandoned, but that the law is itself submitted to abandon. In other words,
mm-hmm.
the law is submitted to an imaginative force rather than the law simply being understood to be like the arm of regulation.
Right.
The law is no longer, you know, that thing which stands behind the police, in other words.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The law is something that the people make, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, not
mm-hmm.
that is something that they are bludgeoned with by,
mm-hmm.
you know. And that the making of law and the making of form is what the living and the dead do.
Mm-hmm.
In the construction of their future, you know, that, and again, that's what's going on in the making of this poem and also in the ongoing making of this poem, the ongoing ceremony that happens every time somebody opens this book, right? We'll be like, okay, what are we gonna do? You know, it's real, it's just like that. Okay, what are we gonna do now?
Mm-hmm.
You know, which is like the one question that like bosses never want you to ask, right? They want you to ask, what should we do? They don't ever want you to ask, what are we going to do? That already, you know, that's that simple question is, you know, that's the death of the boss has been declared in the asking of the question.
And what I find interesting is that there are so many parallels between the law and ceremony. You talked about precision, yes?
Mm-hmm.
Ritual.
Mm-hmm.
The law is all about ritual and precise ritual. You know, you come in, you got to bow, somebody shouts, the judge is here.
Mm-hmm.
People sit down, you're not supposed to wear hats, or you take
mm-hmm.
off your hats, your cell phones, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And ceremony is also about ritual and precision and so on. So
mm-hmm.
so I think, not I think, I know you're right about that, that it's really, there's a much more of a sort of a connection between the two. In fact, one of the things I argue about in this essay is that the law and religion both worked to uphold slavery for a long time, and that what Lamy